start at 5 a.m., so I'm going to make a very long speech. I thanked everybody in the entire world, including my mother, and then I thought, I haven't worked through all my issues yet. I'm going to take that one back. So I think I'll just try and keep it simpler than that. And I want to thank all of you for coming and filling a chair and supporting us in our 23rd year of the North Shore Roundup. We're very proud of our Roundup. Roundups, they seem to be successful in spite of all of us, especially me this year. And as a committee, we made a few changes this year, the major one being that we have decided for the first time to go non-smoking. I hope you approve. And I do thank all the smokers who have respected this wish and are using our lovely smoking lounges. I think it helps disperse the crowd and everything. Thank you very much, all. You hear our friend Keith L. from North Carolina. Keith.
Thank you. My name is Keith Lewis. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm just so grateful to be here. I want to thank Joy, who called me and asked me to come, and I very happily accepted. I'd heard your city was beautiful. I had no idea it was this beautiful. It's just spectacular. I can't tell you. I was talking to my wife on the phone, and I said, we have to come back, and we're going to. It's just marvelous. And Randy, who's been just so great, dragging me around and showing me things. And I want to thank the other speakers. I want to thank Joe, who I had met before, but we're already good friends, because just before my talk, he came up and he wrote me a very spiritual note. And I'll share it with you. No, I won't share it with you. Joe has a way to go. My friend Mike W., who's my very best friend in Alcoholics Anonymous, and who's been, I don't know how to say this, I want to say one of my oldest, but maybe one of my longest friends. Mike and I met before I had a year of sobriety, and he's been very important to me from that time until this one. And then my friend Michael M., who I just love so much. Her story is so powerful. And then Peggy M., who started the group that I went to when I was very, very new in Alcoholics Anonymous in Washington, D.C. She and her husband were very involved in that group, and she helped my sponsor, who helped me. And our Al-Anon speaker, Kathy, whom I haven't heard, but she's from Ohio, she's got to be all right. And I'd like to thank Joy's mother. I don't have any issues with her. Michael and I flew out here. It was kind of an interesting trip. You may have noticed, but Mike goofs off a lot, and we have the same home group, and whenever he goes out of town, one of us go with him and make sure he gets back and things. And we're on a plane having the usual party that you have when you're sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we started bantering with the flight attendants, and one in particular was very nice, So we told her we had a present for her. So we gave her, my favorite little prayer book is something called the Pieté prayer book. And so I gave her one of those, and Mike gave her a rosary because she looked Irish. And she said, I can't thank you enough. She said, and I have a present for you too. And she came back and she brought Mike a little bag, and in it were four miniatures. And she brought me this beautiful bottle of wine wrapped up in a napkin with the nicest little note written on it. And she's just so proud of herself. And I looked at Michael, and he said, yeah, go ahead. So I told her where we were headed and why. And at 39,000 feet, everybody heard, oh, my God, give me those. And I said to her, where were you when I needed you, baby? You know? I want to thank my wife, who at this very moment is sound asleep. But she meant to be up praying for me. What she generally does is pray the hour that I talk. And but her eyes slammed shut at 10 o'clock, and it's past 10 o'clock, so I know she's asleep. And I'm just so grateful for her. I'm grateful for everything. I really am. You're looking at a guy who's not supposed to be here. You're looking at a guy, at the very best I ever could have hoped for was to be under a bridge. And so it's hard to be disappointed with life when you have the life I have. I was born in a small town in Ohio, a place called Martins Ferry. If you haven't heard of it, I wouldn't worry. It's been canceled. And I'm the second child, the eldest son in a family of 11 children. I'm Irish. I won't tell you what church I go to. I'll give you a hint. It has something to do with bingo, but I'm not going to say anything else. And I would have told you when I was drinking that my problem was I grew up in poverty. We were poor. And I would have whined and moaned about that. And I would have had you in tears. And I told you the hard times we had. The only problem with that is that it wasn't true. We didn't have any money or anything else material. And we didn't have an automobile or any of those things. But what we had were things you couldn't buy. I had a mother and a father who loved me desperately. And a mother who every day of her life, and to this day, every day I'm around her, she puts her arms around me and she gives me a hug and a kiss, and she tells me she loves me. And then I had a father who could never tell me he loved me, and that's why I was an alcoholic, you see. I hear a lot about healing the child within. When I came in, they told me I had to discipline the little bastard within. And and you know, I grew up in a house that had things that lived under the bed, and bad things, and I was the only one in the whole house who knew about it, and I knew it was there because at night when the lights were turned out, you know, I'd press my little ear against a mattress and I could hear it moving around down there, and I knew what it was there for. It was waiting for me to dangle my little legs over the side of the bed. Now it's history, you know. I mean, I'd just disappear and. The next morning, they'd miss me at breakfast, and somebody would eat my food, but they would miss me, and they'd say, "Where's Keith?" And they'd go up, and I'd be gone. And they'd say, "Well, I guess that thing under the bed got him." And I never talked about these things. I also had a horrible speech impediment, and I was always tried not to be noticed, and I tried to hide. And the only people who could understand anything I said were my brothers and sisters and my parents. God bless them, they treated me like I was normal, just because they loved me. And I had a grandmother who was an alcoholic grandmother, Granny. She was a piece of work, Granny. She was about 4 feet 9 inches tall, and she was Irish, and she used to drink. And when she drank, her brogue got thicker and thicker the more she drank. And Granny was a fighting drunk. The last time Granny went to jail, she was 73 years old. And She broke a man's 35-year-old man's arm with a bar stool, and because he had an Irish name and he wasn't Irish, and it was St. Patrick's Day, and she thought it was blasphemous, don't you know? And she loved me very much, and we were very best friends, and we used to fight all the time, and. One time I told her that she wasn't going to ride on my fire truck when I grew up. And then one time she got very angry with me, and she called me the worst thing she could think of. She called me a dirty, snake-tongued Englishman. And then she started to cry, and she said, "I'm awfully sorry, lad. I never should hurt your feelings that way." And so she did penance for 2 years because she called me an Englishman. Most of all, like Michael and like Joe and like Mike and other people that you hear, most of all, what I remember about being little was being afraid and never, never, ever talking about it. And I think we could have talked about it. We just never did. And I thought it was a normal state of being. And I grew up in this small town with this wonderful people. And I went off to a Catholic, 12 years of Catholic school. And I was in this Catholic high school and we had a librarian by the name of Sister Victoria. And strange, strange woman, Sister Victoria. You know how those religious types are, you know. And Sister Victoria had the library, and I never forget her. She used to strut around this library like it was a Library of Congress. You know, and it was this tiny little room in this little high school in Blair, Ohio. And I didn't know that she knew what I was to learn in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that is that when you're doing God's will, you're in the Library of Congress. And she just strutted around that library, and she said dumb things like, every boy's a prince, and every girl's a princess because we have a father who's a king. And people like that scared me. You know? And so I would do what often was done. I'd ridicule her, and I'd say things behind her back. And we used to do detention in the library, and I'd spent a lot of time with Sister Victoria. If I were young today, and if we had insurance, I would be called an acting out adolescent. But we were poor, so I was just a punk, you know? And so I got in a lot of trouble, and I spent a lot of time in a library. And what we did when we served detention, we made rosary beads. Those are things that Catholics pray on. And there were 10 beads in each decade, and there are 5 decades in a rosary. We'd make these rosary beads, and we'd send them to the missions all over the world. I made them with 11 beads in each decade. And I did that for 4 years. By the time I was finished, there were hundreds of mutant rosary beads all over the world. And Sister, just before I graduated, you know, you can't let things like this go unnoticed. And she had never said anything to me, and so I thought I'd fill her in. And so I went to see her, and I told her, I said, you know what I've been doing? She said, yes, you sly little prince. I know what you've been doing. You've been putting extra beads in all the rosaries. And she said, I know why you've been doing it. And I remember thinking, I hope she tells me, because I haven't the foggiest idea why I do these things. And she said, you're doing it so that people will pray extra prayers, and God's going to give you all the credit. Don't you hate people like that, you know? You know, the other thing I like to mention is my first drink. I think it's important, if you're going to be an alcoholic, to have your first drink. I think it fits in there, and I had my first drink when I was 5 years old, and I didn't drink alone then. I was at home. I didn't go out much, and my father was watching us, and it was myself and my brother Denny. Dumb Denny's a year younger than I am, and Mom was out. She was either at the bingo or having a baby or something, and Dad was watching us, and I guess he thought it'd be cute, and he got us each a beer. And it was rarely alcohol around our house, but he got us each a beer. We drank it out of those little jelly glasses. Some of you older folks might remember they had cartoon characters on them, you know. Mine had Superman on it. I don't know if that's significant or not, but I drank my beer, and Denny drank his, and I was fine. But I looked over, and old Denny was sliding out of the chair, and he rolled around under the table, and he was singing Mary Had a Little Lamb and other drinking songs, It kind of frightened my father, so he wrestled little Denny to the ground, and he got his clothes off him and put his jammies on him, and Denny's singing and carrying on and laughing. And he took him up, and he put him in his little crib, and I went up, and he said, get ready for bed, son. I said, okay, Dad, and I got ready, and I got into bed. And old Den was over in his bed laughing and jumping up and down, carrying on. And I'll never forget this as long as I live. Old Denny urinated on the floor, you know. And I remember laying there thinking, you know, there's a kid who's powerless over alcohol and whose life has become unmanageable. You know, the strangest thing happened. Denny just never made it. I mean, he just never developed. You know, I'll tell you, we're not proud of this, but the truth's the truth. Denny grew up and went to one college. It gets worse. He had one major. He graduated in 4 years. Went to one graduate school. Straight A student, graduated, you know. It was offered, he had like 8 jobs offered to him. He picked one. And today he's a senior vice president in a large international corporation. And, you know, the strangest thing of all was he married one woman. Now, here's a guy who had the world in the palm of his hands when he was 4 years old, and he just let it slip through his fingers, you know? I had to work at this thing. I was 23 years old before I urinated on the bedroom floor for the first time. You know, I didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up, and I thought I was the only person in the world who felt that way. It seemed, now I never asked, but it seemed to me that everybody knew what they were going to do when they grew up. And I didn't know what I was going to do when I grew up. So I had to leave town. Because if you leave town, people won't know. You don't know what you're supposed to be doing. They'll think you're doing it. And so the way you left town where I came from was you joined the military. So I took my very first inventory. I just graduated from high school at 17 years old. I took my shirt off and I stood in front of the mirror. You know, and I flexed my muscles and I turned sideways and stuck my tongue out. I looked like a zipper. And I was 5 feet, 1 inch tall, and I weighed 113 pounds. And whatever else I was a born killer. So I went over to Wheeling, West Virginia, and I joined the Marine Corps. My parents had to sign for me because I wasn't yet 18 years of age. And so they came over, and the recruiter came over with the paper for my parents to sign. And I forgot to tell them what I was doing. And my mother began to cry and carry on. And she cried all night. I was leaving the next day, and she kept saying to my father, "Scott, they'll kill him." And my dad kept saying, "Don't worry, Pat, they won't take him." And the next morning, they took me across the river to a bus station in Wheeling, West Virginia, and I got on a bus, and I went to Pittsburgh. It's 60 miles away. It was the second longest trip I'd ever taken in my life. And I knew nothing about anything. And I was this skinny little kid who was just terrified. It was a bad year, and they took anybody who had a pulse. So that afternoon, I was sworn in the Marine Corps, and that night, my life changed, and it changed in a dramatic fashion. There were three guys from the Pittsburgh area who joined, and we left the post office at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Our train left at midnight, which gave us 8 hours. They said, "Look, we're going to go over and have a few beers. You want to come along?" And I figured, what do I know? I'm from out of town. So I tagged along behind them, and they went into this bar. And I don't know if you've ever been in a bar in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, but, you know, it's a steel town. And coal mines, you know, and this bar was filled with real men, you know the kind, and they all had real women with them. Real women are women who hang around with real men, you know? And I didn't know what to do, and so I followed these guys over, and they sat down, and the bartender came. He was a real man, and he said, "What do you want?" And I thought, oh no, a quiz, you know. When you least expect it, they're going to say, "Take a blank sheet of paper out and put your name in the upper left-hand corner." And they were going to ask a bunch of questions that I hadn't studied for. That's the way I felt about life. And I didn't know what to say, so I watched the other guys, and they all ordered a beer, so I did too. And then they came back, and he asked the same question. They gave the same answer. Then he came back the third time. I knew the answer. Between the second and third beer, my life changed in such a way it was never going to be the same again. And if you're an alcoholic, you know precisely what I mean. And if you're an Al-Anon, you've watched us, and you know exactly what I mean. I changed dramatically. I had a spiritual awakening. I did. I stood up. If a spiritual awakening is that reality shifts completely, then that's exactly what happened to me. And I stood up. I didn't mean to stand up, but I couldn't have kept from standing up. I just stood up. And the floor was 6 feet, 4 inches below me. And my right shoulder was out to here, and my left shoulder was out to there, and the muscles were rippling through my body and tugging at my shirt. And that mind that had been filled with fear and doubt, all of a sudden, like, boom, was crystal clear. And I said, "Of course, it's so simple. Why didn't I see it before?" For the very first time in my life, I saw the big picture, and I understood everything there was to know. And I looked up, and my heart broke, because this place was filled with a bunch of pathetic, snivelling little men. And all of them had women with them or looking at me with those hungry eyes. You know how they do it. And I went around that place for the next 8 hours. I went from table to table. These people had so many questions. And I was just filling them in. I had answers to questions that they had wondered about for years. I answered questions they hadn't come up with yet. I mean, I had it all. It was perfect. It was the most perfect evening of my life, before or since. And I spent the next 12 years trying to go back to Pittsburgh. It was perfect. And I could never quite get to Pittsburgh. I could get to the suburbs sometimes. You know, sometimes I'd get in the state of Pennsylvania, but I couldn't get back to that feeling of being in Pittsburgh. And that's what I chased. And, you know, I went and got on a train that night, and I went into a blackout, and I woke up the next morning, and I was laying on the floor of the Pullman coach that the Marine Corps had kindly provided for me. And someone had wet the floor I was lying on, and whoever it was, they had wet me too. And and I got up, and I changed my clothes, and I was again 5'1" tall, and I was weighed 113 pounds, and I got off the train, and the guys were waiting on the platform, and they said, look, we're going to go over and have a couple beers. You want to come along? And I thought, what do I know? I'm from out of town. And I followed them over, and that night I fell off a train in a place called Yamasee, South Carolina. And somebody moved a bottom step. I don't know what happened, but I fell across the next set of railroad tracks, and it was a man they had sent there to greet us, and a very rude man. And he was hurling obscenities at myself and the other young men who had gone down there to die for our country. And I remember getting up trying to explain to this cretin that he'd probably do better if he treated us with a little respect. And he never seemed to grasp my argument. And the only thing I learned from that experience was I can do a lot of push-ups drunk. A lot of push-ups drunk. And I'll tell you something else. You can do push-ups and throw up at the same time. You can do that. And I've always been grateful that he didn't have me do sit-ups. And I was launched into my first career as a Marine, and I must say I loved it. I loved everything about the Marine Corps. Next to the nuns, it was easy. And next to the family I grew up in, the barracks was relatively uncrowded. And there was always plenty of food, and I just loved it. And I decided I was going to spend the rest of my life in the Marine Corps. And I went to work the way an alcoholic goes to work. I mean, I went after with all the vigor I had. And, you know, and I grew a few inches. I gained about 30 pounds. I really took to it. And I won Dress Blues Award, an Outstanding Man's Award out of Paris Island. And I went, I got all these meritorious promotions, and I studied hard. And within 4 years, I was offered a commission. I was the youngest NCO in the Marine Corps, and I was going to be the youngest officer in the Marine Corps. The problem was I was alcoholic. And let me tell you what that means to me. Being alcoholic means that I'll fall madly in love with a way of life. And then I will slowly, sometimes quickly, violate every principle associated with that way of life. And you know, within 4 years, I had violated virtually every principle associated with the United States Marine Corps, including leading a combat patrol in a blackout. I drank on duty. I did everything that I knew I could never, ever do. And I reacted to it the way I reacted to everything. I ended up getting out at the last minute, and I blamed them for what I had done. And then I became married, and I did exactly the same thing. I wanted to be married. I loved the state of marriage. I watched my father idolize my mother. Mike knows him. He idolized him. They lived at the little beach house I have in North Carolina for a while, and we'd look out the window, and they'd be sitting on the swing, and he'd have his arm around her, and they'd be swinging and looking at the ocean. He just idolized her. We were never permitted to say anything cross to her or about her. And I watched him. I watched the way he gently dealt with this woman who had all these children and of his, and she was a princess and is to this day. They've been married 55 years. And he idolizes the ground that she walks on. And I wanted to be just like that. And I ended up violating virtually every principle associated with the state of marriage. And one day that was over. And that's what I did with everything. And I don't want to stay drunk very long because drunk isn't where the action is. Anybody who has this disease can be drunk. The miracle is when we get sober. And just we had a couple children, and one day my wife asked me to leave because she couldn't trust me with the children anymore. I was passing out with cigarettes and just all this stuff that happens. And I went to where I needed to go in order to get better, and that was the Skid Row section of Washington, D.C. I lived on Harvard Street in Washington, D.C., in a place called Mount Pleasant. And I lived in a basement of a house, and that's where I spent the last 6 months of my drinking. And I went to the place I needed to go. I ended up drinking in bootleg joints on 14th Street, and I'd sit around and make racial remarks. And a guy picked me up one day, he's bigger than Roosevelt Greer, and he shoved a .45 in my mouth, and he said, "I'd kill you, you big mouth honky, but I don't want to do you no favors." And he threw me out of a bootleg joint. Now, you think getting thrown out of a bar is one thing. Bootleg joints are always in a basement. And, you know, getting thrown down the steps is one thing, but boy, getting thrown up the steps, that's a terrible thing to have happen, you know. You go up a couple steps and you stop abruptly. Then they pick you up and they throw you up a couple more and you stop. And I was never so pleased to see anything as I was to see that sidewalk when I rolled under the car. And then I went home to die. And you know, there's a certain inevitability about that in my life. And I went back to this place I was living in and I drank around the clock for I don't know how long. To this day, it may have been a week, may have been 2 weeks. I have the foggiest notion. All I know was that it was pitch black in that place. I would call liquor stores and they would deliver booze, very civilized. And they would deliver booze. And I'd always say good day because I didn't know if it was morning or afternoon or evening. And I'd call sometimes and they wouldn't answer and it must have been night. It was that horror and that hell that I went through for the next couple of weeks. And then I woke up one day and all I knew was that for me it was over. And it was May the 13th, 1973. And I went into what passed for a bathroom in order to kill myself. And I had a whole medicine cabinet full of pills. I worked in hospitals, as my wife had. And I had all kinds of tranquilizers, all kinds of things. And I never took them. Some of you think that's the saddest story you ever heard, but I just never took them. But I had a whole medicine cabinet full of these things. And that morning, I began to take them. I think. I don't know. I got them ready to take. And I said out loud, "You're 29 years old, and at least it'll be over." And this voice, woman's voice, as clear as anything I've ever heard in my life, said to me, "When you're 29, it's not supposed to be over. It's supposed to be starting." And it startled me. And I'd been in a fog for such a long time, it startled me. And I looked around, and there was no one there. But immediately, I remembered that I had two phone numbers that this poor woman who put up with my abuse gave me. And I ran in and I pulled a drawer out and I could only find one. And I called it. And it happened to be to a little treatment center outside of Washington, D.C. on the Potomac River. It was in a condemned hotel. And a lot of speakers get a lot of miles out of saying bad things about treatment centers. And I can't do that because if that place hadn't been there, I don't think I'd be alive today. And I called that place, and a kind lady with a British accent, I'll never forget it as long as I live, answered the phone. And I think she heard in my voice the suicide and everything. And she said, "Honey, I'll have to call you right back. Will you give me your phone number?" And I know now that that's the way she could trace me. And I hung up the phone, and I sat down on the floor, and she called back. And I answered the phone, and we talked for a little bit. And she said, "You can come in a few days." And I didn't know what they did there. I didn't know what was wrong with me. I clearly didn't think I was alcoholic. But I just needed some place to be. And I said to her, "You know, if you can't help me, I think I'll have to die." And I didn't know how true that was. And I hung up the phone, and I looked, and there was a fifth of scotch left on the draining board. And I didn't know it was there. And it was just open, and there was just a little bit out of it. And I ran over, and I grabbed that. And let me tell you, I think that if you're kind of new, even if you aren't new, take a look at your life and pick out the thing that was special. I think God gives us all one little special gift when we start this journey. And pick out what's special. It may be a close friend. I don't know what it is. For me, it was this. I knew that if I took one more drink of alcohol, I'd die. And knowing that would never keep me from taking it. I had on several occasions tried to frighten myself into not drinking. I worked in a teaching hospital, and they have autopsies there, and they list what people died of, sort of like coming attractions, you know. And if you're interested in that, you could go watch The Post. And when an old person in their 40s or so would die of alcohol, of chronic alcoholism, I'd sometimes scrub in and watch them. And then I'd see their liver and their brain, and I couldn't take much of it. And I'd leave there, and I'd go to Clyde's or Chadwick's, and I'd say, God, Vinny, you better give me a double. You'll never guess what I just saw. And he'd say, well, you always get a double. I said, well, you better make it a triple. And then the other people sitting at the bar would say, well, what'd you see? And I'd explain to them what this person did to themselves. And they'd say, oh, my God, give us a triple, too. And we'd sit there and drink till 2 in the morning and wonder how people could do that to themselves. And they have no self-respect, no nothing. So I knew that I could never, ever frighten myself sober. I knew it. And I knew if I took one drink of alcohol, I'd die. And knowing that would never keep me from taking it. And do you know that's true today? It's absolutely true today. If I take one drink of alcohol, I'll die. And knowing I'm going to die will never keep me from taking it. The only chance I have is a miracle. And you're it. You know, I grabbed that bottle and I ran out and I knew I'd never pour it out. I'd never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know Alcoholics Anonymous existed. And I certainly never heard the first step. But I knew that I was powerless over alcohol. And I threw the bottle in the sink and it broke. And if it bounced, I don't know that I'd be here. And then for the next few days, I did what alcoholics do when they stop drinking abruptly. Michael talked about it. I saw those things and I heard those things and I lost hours at a time and all the things that happened. And one day, it was time to go and I somehow got a shower and I packed some clothes and I went down and I got my old alcoholic car. That's the alcoholic car is one that goes like 35,000 miles between oil changes, you know. The oil was so thick, you have to leave it overnight so it'll drain. And I got in that car, and I had to drive 30 miles, and it took me 5 hours to go 30 miles because I had the thing that we used to call the horrors. And I could drive for a little while, and the fear would take over, and I begin to shake and cry and sweat. And then I wet my pants, and I'm changing my pants outside the car, outside of Washington, D.C., and wonder what happened to the guy they talked about with all that potential. I always had that potential back there. And you know, when life got too bad, I was going to reach back and grab that potential, and I was going to beat the world's brains out with it. You know, I turned around and there was nothing there. I drank up all my potential. And somehow I got to that place, and that night they took me to a place called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I walked into that meeting, and I'll never forget it as long as I live. Ever forget it as long as I live. There was a man who stood at the door and he shook hands, obnoxious kind of a guy. You know, like had all the greeters out here. They were, some of them were like that too. The obnoxious kind, they look you in the eye, you know, the kind, you know. And the guy looked me in the eye. It's like he had two heads. Wherever I looked, his head was there looking me in the eye. And I was a shoe guy and he was an eye guy. And eye guys and shoe guys don't get on very well. But, you know, I had to admit it. The guy was pretty smart. He was psychic. He said to me, oh, you're new, aren't you? And I remember thinking, how does he know? You know? And so he took me in and he introduced me to an old woman that's 10 days older than dirt, the oldest human being I ever saw in my life. And she got me a half a cup of coffee and she sat beside me and patted me. You know? And about halfway through the meeting, that old lady looked at me and her face exploded into a smile. And she said, you know, honey, you keep coming here, you never have to be alone again. And I realized that what I was alone. And I began to cry. And I think for me, that's when the miracle began to happen. I recognized that I was alone. And it made sense to me. I remember the nights I'd be lying next to the woman I was married to. And I'd feel completely and utterly alone. And I'd sneak in at night, you know. And I'd slip out of my clothes in the other room. And I'd sneak in and I'd slide into bed. And I'd lay perfectly still like I was asleep. And I know now that she was laying over there wide awake, perfectly still, like she was asleep. And then there were the nights when I couldn't sleep, and I'd get up and I'd walk out, and I'd go into Kimberly and Kelly's little room, and they'd be in their cribs, and I'd touch their heads. And I'd smell them, you know, the way babies smell with baby powder and oil and everything. And I'd know something that night couldn't have anything to do with me. And I was completely and utterly alone. And it took me about a week to fall in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm not a bit ashamed of that. It took me a week. And one day, I came back to this little treatment center, and I had a roommate who had everything that I ever wanted to be happy. He was tall. I used to think it was a blessing. Now I realize tall people were mutants. He owned a couple farms on the Eastern Shore of Maryland. He had a Corvette outside of the thing, and the women loved him. I mean, they just wouldn't leave him alone. You know, even in a treatment center, these women are calling him all the time and trying to come and see him and everything. And I said to my roommate, I said, you know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, those are the most wonderful people I've ever met in my life. I said, I'm going to do whatever they tell me to do. If they tell me to sit in a tree, I'm going to try not to ask why. I'm going to go sit in a tree. And he looked at me and he said, my God, they've brainwashed you. And I thought, I hope so, because if anybody's brain needs washing, it's mine. And you know, and you did, you brainwashed me. You filled my head full of dreams and things that just couldn't happen to a guy like me. And then I watched him happen. It's absolutely astounding what took place. I threw myself into Alcoholics Anonymous in the greatest way. I got myself a sponsor. Peggy knew well. Peggy helped Dan and his whole, there was just a whole gang of them that hung together, and Peggy and Dick and people like that would help him. And Dan became sort of the model of what I wanted to be if and when I grew up. And he was a magnificent man who absolutely insisted on enjoying life. And in every first, or just about every first I had in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had as a result of him. My first 12-step call was to the D.C. jail. And he called me up, and I was sober less than 3 months. He said, Keith, we're going to go on a 12-step call. I said, do you think I'm ready? And he said, no, but I can't get up with anybody else. And he took me to the D.C. jail, and we went in, and we had to talk to a man through this thick glass, and Dan talked to him for about 45 minutes on this phone through the thick glass. And I could hear Dan, and I couldn't hear this guy, but I was watching this guy, and he's jawing away and stuff. And Dan said, I'm going to let you talk to a friend of mine for a couple of minutes. His name's Keith. He said, Keith is really getting a hold of this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I grabbed that phone, and I began to tell that guy how it worked. I began to tell him about the steps. I got into higher power. I mean, in 5 minutes, man, I gave him everything I had. And I never forget, he said to me, he said, well, he said, that's fine for you. He said, you seem to be sort of a intellectually and mentally limited type. He said, I'm a Fulbright scholar. And I just lost it. And I began to scream into the phone, well, Mr. Fulbright scholar, one of us is going to leave here and go to dinner, and one of us is going to go back to a cell and get locked up like an animal. And I was screaming in the phone, and Dan was trying to pull the phone away from me. The guards came running over to see what was going on, and the guy behind the thing threw the phone down and took off. So Dan finally got me out of there, and I knew I was going to be kicked out of Alcoholics Anonymous. Walking across the parking lot, I said, that was pretty bad, wasn't it, Dan? And he said, well, Keith, he said, I got to be honest with you. He said, now, most guys wouldn't have done it that way. He said, but hey, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, everybody develops their own patterns around here. Yeah. I had a lot of problems when I got sober, never forget. One of them was being impotent, which will really put a crimp in your sex life. And I want to warn you about some things, okay? There are some old-timers around. Mike's an old-timer, and Peggy's an old-timer and stuff. And you know, we had a couple who stood up last night with 40-some years of sobriety. A lot of people with 30-some years of sobriety, 25, you know. I'd like to warn you to stay away from old-timers. They're really not well people. They're really not. They'll tell you things that aren't true. They'll say things like, well, I need to come to AA meetings. That's not true. They don't need to come to AA meetings. The only reason they come to AA meetings is the only enjoyment they get out of life is watching people like you and me suffer. And if you don't believe that, find one of them after the meeting and tell them a problem you have. First thing they do is burst into laughter, you know? And if you really want to give them a good time, tell them a sexual problem. They love those, you know? They're not having sex anymore, and they don't want you to have any either. So I go to this old-timer, and I said to him, I said, well, I got a problem. He said, what is it? I said, I'm impotent. He goes, oh. He said, a lot of us had that problem. He said, it'll go away. I said, well, when? I thought it was important. And he said, well, you got a full social calendar? You know, so. Some of you knew you can't sleep? Don't look for sympathy around this bunch. And I'm used to go. At the very end of the meeting, they'd say, now, does anybody here have a problem they need to mention that might make them drink? Now, they had never asked before the meeting because they didn't give a damn what your problems were, you know, because they were into solutions, if you can imagine such a thing. But at the very end, they'd say, anybody here have a problem? I'd put my hand up. And I'd say, I can't sleep. And they'd take turns. They go, nobody ever died from not sleeping. You know, you're talking to a madman. I jumped up and screamed, no, but people died from saying nobody ever died from not sleeping. It's a crazy man. My sponsor said, you know, you'll sleep. I said, well, when? He said, when you're ready. I said, I'm ready now. He said, you can't be. So why? He said, because you're awake. Drive you crazy. And then they like to disappoint you. You know, they like to build you up and then disappoint you. You know what, I was sober 3 months, and I got a letter from a guy named Jerome Lejeune. He just died recently. He's probably the greatest cytologist that ever lived. And he was at the University of Paris Medical School and at the hospital for sick children in Paris, France. And he wrote me a letter, and he asked me to come and study with him. And I was going to tell him no, because I was not going to give my sponsor the satisfaction of telling me I couldn't do it. But I thought about it, and I said, well, so I arranged to have lunch with him, and I showed him the letter, and he said, isn't this wonderful? He said, this is wonderful. I said, really? He said, yeah. I said, you mean I can go? He said, you have to go. He said, you owe it to Alcoholics Anonymous to go. And then he told me something I'll never forget as long as I live. He said, Keith, if you're sober and an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, you can go anywhere and do anything. He said, I said, Dan, I didn't think you'd let me go. He said, you have to go. He said, I insist that you go. And he said, Keith, it's not where you go, it's how you go that matters. And we began for the next 3 months to prepare me to go to France to study with this great man. And you know, I got on that plane, and I hate to fly. Michael and I talk about it all the time, and I'm terrified of flying. I got on that plane, and I'd never been on a plane sober except when they flew me into places I'd get shot at. And I landed in Orly Airport, and I'll never forget that day as long as I live. It was New Year's Eve, 1973, and a plane came down through the clouds into Orly Airport, and I'm glad I was by myself sitting next to that window because I just cried. 6 months before, I couldn't leave a tiny little dive in the Skid Row section of Washington, D.C., and now I'm walking the streets of Paris a free man. And I went to meetings over there, and I went to meetings in, you know, languages I couldn't speak. Well, hell, I drank in bars where they spoke languages I couldn't speak. And it was amazing to me. And while I was there, the strangest thing, my sponsor happened to come through town. I don't know how these things happen. You know. Called me up. He said, Keith, it's Dan. I said, Dan, you sound like you're just around the corner. He said, I am just around the corner. And get over here, I want to talk to you. And he told me where he was, and I went over. And I said, what are you doing here? He said, Susan and I were just one day. We said, what do you want to do? He said, well, let's go see Keith. And they came over to see me, and they spent a week with me, and it was absolutely magnificent. And I learned a little bit more about Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, Michael talked so well about the steps. Mike W. was telling her that she left 2 pages out of the big book that she was talking. I mean, it's so thorough that it's so hard to add anything to a magnificent talk like that. But I'd like to talk a little bit about the ninth step and what the ninth step means. I mean, I always hear people talk about the promises, and there are people who read them at every meeting and all the rest of it. And they don't say things like, you know, this happens when you're halfway through the ninth step. And people walk around thinking that this is supposed to happen if you just don't drink and go to meetings. And that isn't what does it. What does it is working these steps. You know, I had a few amends to make in my life, and I want to share some of those with you. I was with my I was sitting one day praying and looking at my eight-step list, and I ran into old dumb Denny. He was just right there. And Denny was living in New Jersey at the time, and I got in my car in Washington, and I drove up to see him, and he wasn't there. And so I drove back, and because I knew the time wasn't right. And then I drove up the next time, and he was there, and we began to talk. And I said, you know, Den, I came here because I owe you an amends, and I owe you some restitution. I said, I've been so intimidated by you and your success that every chance I've had, I've said bad things about you. I said, I've detracted from you. And he said, I said, for the last 6 months, I've done just the opposite. I've told everybody the fine things that are...
Testing, 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 testing. 1, 2, 3, 4, test.
He said, all my life I've been afraid. He said, I was always afraid to change. And he said, I've watched you. And he said, Keith, you never gave a shit about anything. He said, if things weren't going well in one country, you'd go to another country. He said, you've gone to more universities and I can count on two hands. And he said, life has just never beaten you like I know it would beat me. He said, you lost your wife and your children and you came back. He said, you went to Skid Row and you came back. And I discovered something, that Denny and I aren't good and bad, we're just different. And it's a nice kind of a difference. And now we're best friends. And he really is a senior vice president in a large international corporation. And he lives in a beautiful home near San Francisco on a beautiful golf course, which I go and play with him just so he doesn't get lonely. And we're best friends. And you know something? I'm the executor of his estate. You know why? Because he trusts me more than anybody in the world. And he loves you because of what you've done to me. He said to me one time, he said, I don't think you know what you have there, your friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, oh, really? He said, yeah. He said, we played in that golf tournament with all those folks one time. And he said, we met two guys on the first tee. He said, you never saw them before in your life. He said, by the fourth hole, you're cursing each other and calling each other names. He said, I don't have friends that I've known for 20 years that I'm that easy with. And it's really true. We have something special that happens with us. You know, I went to that father who never told me he loved me. And you know, I drove from Washington, D.C. to Ohio 3 times to make amends to that man. And the same thing happened each time. I'd be there about 5 minutes, I'd be drinking a cup of coffee, and this rage would well up inside of me, and I'd get up and I'd go in my car and I'd drive back 300 miles. And I'd say to my sponsor, I can't do it, I can't make amends to that man, he doesn't give a damn about me, doesn't give a damn about anybody. And, you know, my sponsor would say things like, yeah, you know, he just needed a place to hang around all these years with his wife and 11 children. Yeah. And he'd say, you know, you're almost ready to do it. He said, I think you're real close. I think you need to pray a little bit more. I said, all right, I'll pray a little bit more, but I don't think it's going to work. And then I pray a little bit more, and I go back, and the same thing had happened. And then finally, I realized one day that, you know, my father had never seen the ocean. Had never seen the ocean. He'd raised children who had studied all over the world and run all over the world. And he had never seen the ocean. I had a little house on the ocean. I still have it. There's a little sign on it that says, CZ does it. And I invited my mother and father down, and they wouldn't get on an airplane, but they got on a bus, and they took a bus down, and I took my father out on the deck of this house, and he stood and he watched the ocean go back and forth. He said, oh my God, does it just keep doing that? And I said, long as I've been watching. And he said, this is magnificent. And then I left town for a couple of years, and he called me up, and he said, I know you're probably worried about your house, and your mother and I will keep an eye on it for you. And they lived down there for 6 years. And then I went down to see him one day, and I was ready. I had prayed enough. And I said to him, I said, you know, Dad, I've come to make amends to you. And I said, you know, the things I did, I was discharged from the Marine Corps, and I went home 11 days later. I didn't know what parents went through. I didn't know they had called every state highway patrol and every morgue within hundreds of miles, finding out their son was dead someplace. I didn't know that because I was too self-centered. And I began to tell him the things that I wanted to make amends for. And he said, I'll never forget this as long as I live. He said, you know, son, he said, I never felt like I could ever tell you anything. I said, what do you mean, Dad? He said, well, he said, all my kids let me help them do things. He said, they let me help them go to college and everything. You know, he never owned a car until the last kid went through school. He raised 11 of us and educated us. And then he raised a few kids who didn't have any place else to go. And he said, you never let me help you. He said, you went to school on your own. You did all those things. You never let me help you. And then I knew why I owed him an amends. I owed him an amends because I robbed that man of the most precious gift in the world, and that is to parent and father a child. And I said to him, I said, Dad, I am so sorry. And he said, yeah, he said, you know, you went to work when you were real little. He said, you remember your first job? And I said, yeah, I set pins in a bowling alley. He said, you remember your first day of work? And I said, no, I don't. He said, I took you to lunch. We went to Louis' hot dog stand. He said, do you remember what you had? And I said, well, I probably had a hot dog and an orange pop. He said, no. He said, that day, he said, you always had orange pop other times, but that day you had a root beer. He said, I drank root beer, and I think you thought men who work drank root beer. And he said, I told you, son, if you're going to go to work for a man, you owe him a good day's work, and he owes you a good day's wage. And you owe him the same kind of respect that you would have for your mother and father, and he owes you the same kind of respect he would have for a man who's working. He said, and then I took you down to the bus stop, and the job was in the next town. And I said to you, son, do you want me to come with you on your first day? And you said to me, no thanks, Dad, I'll do it myself. And he said, I watched my tiny 12-year-old boy get on the bus. And he said, you never look back. He said, I watched till the bus was out of sight, and you never look back. And he said, from that day on, I never felt as though I had a right to tell you anything. And you know what the book says is true. People treat us the way we force them to treat us. And I said to him, Dad, I need you. I need you to be my dad. And he said, I'd love to be. And you know, I was working, and I was an officer in a corporation, and this corporation was doing things that I couldn't be involved in and stay sober. But it was a kind of job that I was told you're always supposed to have. And you know, when you're a poor kid coming out of what I came out of, you're supposed to want to be an officer in a large corporation. And I prayed about it, and I talked to some people in AA about it, and I went to North Carolina and I talked to my dad about it. And I never forget what he said to me. He was sitting in the chair rocking back and forth, and he said, you know, son, you've done more with life than I've ever done. And I thought, never. And he said, the one thing I know about you, since you started hanging around with those AA people, you're a winner because they help you do what's right. He said, do what's right. And then he said to me, he said, you know, there's more to do than God has people to do it. And you'll never want for things to do. And you know, I went back and I resigned that position. It was the best move I'd ever made. And you know, and then that year, Dad got cancer, and he told my mother, he said, call Keith and ask him to be here, but don't tell any of the other kids what's going on. It'll ruin their Christmas. And so I ran to North Carolina, and I did tell the other kids because they had a right to know, and they stayed home, but they prayed. And in Christmas of 1984, I was sitting in a hospital in Wilmington, North Carolina with my little mother and my father. It was the best Christmas I ever had. I was this man's son, and I was available. And before he went into surgery, he said, I'm so glad you're here, son. There's nobody I would rather have here than you. Watch after your mother. And you know, he went into surgery and he came out, and as a result of the drugs and the stuff that they had him on, he saw things. And I remember he was just terrified. He was holding my hand. And he said to me, son, there are bugs over there. Do you see the bugs? And I said, no, I don't see them, Dad. I said, but this has to do with perception. And if you see them, they're there. I said, but I'm here. And I won't let them hurt you. And he just held my hand. And I was reminded of the time when I was 5 years old, and this man who never told me he loved me. I was a very sick child, and I had denied that. And that's why I had to be a Marine, and why I had to climb mountains, and why I had to do that stuff. But I was a very, very sick little boy, and holding his hand, I remembered that. And I was sitting on a park bench, and I was 4 or 5 years old, and I had a blanket around me. And we were watching the other kids swim and things. And my dad put his arm around me, and he said, "You know, son," he said, "they're swimming now, but one day you'll do all these things." And the thing that the ninth step does is it opens me up and it makes me free to see the love that's always been there. Alcoholism is a disease that guarantees I won't see the love that's always been around me. And the ninth step, all the steps, but the ninth step, that step that opens me up so that I can see the love that's always been there. These people have always loved me. Always. And you know, and I owed amends to spiritual people and religious people. And I went down to a little retreat center, and Mike and I used to go to every quarter. We'd go to a silent retreat, and this was before we started doing that. And I hunted up a priest. I had taken a degree in theology in philosophy by this time out of Georgetown, and so I knew a young priest who was a theologian, and I was going to go down and make amends to him, to impress him, to show him what a humble person I was, and I couldn't find him. He was just never in his room, but I kept going by this old man's room, and he was sitting in his little rocking chair, and he was rocking back and forth reading his breviary, his Bible, so it suddenly occurred to me that maybe God wanted me to talk to him, and I went in, and I sat down in a rocking chair across from him, and we rocked, and we talked, and I told him why I was there, and I told him how I had ridiculed people like him, and I'd made fun of people like him, and what I really was afraid of people who were spiritual and holy. And I began to tell him what it was like to be on Skid Row and to do the things I did. And you know, the man stood up and he pulled me out of the chair and he put his arms around me and he began to pat me and he began to cry. And he said, "You know, boy, God sent you here." He said, "I've been a priest for 50 years. And he said, "I have a disease that's going to take me or going to allow me to go home soon." And he said, as I was just sitting here asking God where I had failed as a priest. And he said, "I realize now that I didn't do what my higher power told me to do." He said, "My higher power told me to leave the 99 who agreed with him and go after the one that was lost." And he said, "Sometimes I didn't do that." And he said, "I'm awful sorry you had to be out there all alone." And I discovered something. I discovered that religious people are people who do the best they can with what they have today. And that makes me a religious person as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My life has been touched in ways by you that I can't describe. You know, I had a brother, his name's Terry, and the day of my 20th AA anniversary, I got a call and my dear brother Terry died. And Terry was only 44 years of age. And when I was sober 2 years, Terry had 90 days of continuous sobriety. And for whatever reason, the miracle didn't happen for him. And Terry resented me horribly. He resented the fact that I was sober. And I'd try to go, when I'd go home, Terry found out I was coming, he'd leave town. And I didn't see Terry for the longest kind of time. And he was on my eighth step list, and I very much wanted to make amends to Terry. And my parents had their 50th wedding anniversary, and Terry came, and Terry was drunk. Of course he was. And my brothers and sisters got together, and they had the obligatory anger, and they said, "Why does he have to come here like that? Doesn't he know this is a special time for Mom and Dad?" And I was able to make amends to him. I was able to make direct amends to him because I got my brothers and sisters together and I said, "Please don't make him feel bad." I said, "He feels terrible being here like that." I said, "He must love them more than us to come here like that." And they were all free. And they went over and they put their arm around him and they welcomed him in. And he was dead drunk and he was saying stupid things and they just loved him and were with him, and I got to make amends to him. And then I got a call that said that Terry found Terry was living in a basement of a dive in the Skid Row section of our hometown. And he was very, very sick, and they put him in a hospital, and it turned out that he had cancer. And I came up to visit him. And my family was so pleased that I was there and that they wouldn't leave me alone. And I kept trying to see Terry, and I'd go over, and there'd be 20 people with me. So I got up Sunday, and we went to Mass and came back, and I said, I have to get out of here. I have to get back to North Carolina. And I left the house, and I ran over to see Terry. And I spent about 2 hours with Terry, and he had a lot of questions. You know, we talked a lot about God, and he had this funny smile, and his impish sort of smile, and he said to me, he said, you know, he said, I didn't leave town this time. And I said, I know. I said, I'm so glad. And then he began to ask me questions like, tell me about prayer. What do you think about God? You think that God really does forgive us? And I said, I know he does. And then we talked about things that Catholics do, like a brown scapular and a rosary, and I just happened to have a couple with me, and even some instructions on how to pray the rosary and things, and I showed him and helped him do it. And I said, you do that every day, and he said, I will. And then I got to do what I'd wanted to do for years. I got to hug my brother Terry. He was very, very frail, and I couldn't hug him for long because he was an alcoholic. And, you know, alcoholics don't want to get too close too long. But, you know, I remembered something I learned when I was studying theology. You know, Aquinas and Augustine talked about a theological construct. And it's, in essence, says that it's never too late. What they said was that there are two kinds of time. There's chronological time called chronos, which we do. And, you know, and that's, we keep track of that with minutes and hours and days and months and years. And then there's something called kairos, which is God's time. And God's time is always right now. And it's always forever. And I got to hug my brother for just a few seconds. But I got to hug him forever. And you know, I think in terms of quantity and not quality. And I went to leave, and he said to me, he said, you know, I don't drink anymore. I said, I know, and I'm very, very proud of you. And he said, I've always been kind of proud of you, too. And he talked about a time that I didn't know about, but he was sleeping on a pool table in a bar in the Wheeling Island. And I was on a Today show to talk about some things. And his job at that time was to swamp out the bar the next morning, and slept on a pool table at night, and then got up and swept it out and drank beer. And he turned the TV on, and he looked up, and he said, you were on television. He said, I called Mom and Dad and told them and that you were on television. And he said, I watched you. And he said, I said, my brother Keith is on a Today show, and people all over the world are seeing him. He said, I was so proud of you. He said, I almost called you and told you. You know, when I was sober just a short period of time, I learned, I think, the great spiritual principle for me, and I want to share that with you before I go. I used to run to old-timers and whom I love and always will love and never want to be one. but I used to run to old-timers and ask them questions. And I think they finally got tired of me And one of them said to me, he said, look, he said, it was the old guy I used to go talk to all the time. He said, I want you to do something for me. I said, I'll do anything. And he said, I want you to borrow lipstick from one of the girls. He said, now, I don't want you doing anything else with the girls. And he said, oh, that's right, you can't. He said, I want you to borrow lipstick from one of the girls, and I want you to go right on the mirror, Keith, you were wrong. I said, well, I can't do that. You see, my problem is I have a poor self-image, and I have to be affirmed. Don't ever talk that way to an old-timer. They never read any of those books. So I went and I bought a tube of lipstick, and I went home and I wrote on my mirror, Keith, you were wrong. And I took it and I threw it in a trash can. I was just disgusted. I said, this is the stupidest thing I ever saw in my life. And I went off to bed. And I had a normal night. Remember a normal night at about 50 days? Oh, I lay down and closed my eyes, and for the first time that day, my head woke up. You know, my mind was racing, and it took off, and I would talk to myself. I'd say things like, "You're never going to make it. Those people are going to find out you're not an alcoholic, that you're a head case, and they're going to throw you out of Alcoholics Anonymous. You're going to be alone the rest of your life. What difference does it make? You're impotent." You know? And I'd sleep fitfully. I'd be up and down and up and down all night. And then finally, I'd drift off to sleep, and then the leg cramps would start. Remember the leg cramps? Oh, my goodness. You know? And then about 10 minutes before I had to get up, I'd fall sound asleep. And it would take 3 clocks to wake me up. And I'd wake up, and I'd be so depressed, and my mind was still working. And it would be saying things like, "You're going to go to work, and they're going to find out you don't know how to do your job." You know? And then I go out and I start the coffee, and I felt so bad I just wanted to cry. And I walked in the bathroom and said, "Keith, you were wrong." I said, "Well, thank God, if I'm right, I'm in a hell of a lot of trouble." And so the great spiritual principle is being wrong. And if you can be wrong, you can have it all. But being right is what locks us into having none of it. Being right is what makes me stand on the outside. And I got to tell you, I've been wrong about everything. I was wrong about my parents. You know, the freedom I've received from making amends to my parents is, I think, what's talked about in the fourth commandment. It says in the big book that there's only one commandment with promise, and that's if you honor your mother and father. And the promise is long life. And I always thought that meant you lived a long time, but I no longer think that. I think what it means is that if you can honor your parents, no matter what they're like, no matter what they did, if you can honor your parents, you'll have the honor and love of your children. And that's a long time. It spreads itself over generations. Last week, I was in Alabama, and my lovely daughter, Kimberly, who's getting married in June, she and her fiancé came up to have dinner with me and to hear me talk. And my other daughter, Kelly, lives in Raleigh, North Carolina, and we get together a lot. And her husband has sort of adopted me and as his dad, because his dad's very close to death. And Jim just likes to come down to the beach house and talk. And I'm just available to them. And that's long life. And one day I expect they'll have children, and then maybe they'll let me play with them. And that's longer life. You really will cease fighting everything, even alcohol. And a day comes when we're so free, so very, very free, that the only alternative we have is to try to give it away. I have the greatest sponsor in the world, and I sponsor the greatest guys in the world. I belong to a great home group. It's not the greatest one yet, but we're not finished with it yet, are we, Mike? I have the best friends in the world. I'm married to the best woman in the world. I'm married to a woman I love so very, very much, I can't believe it's me. Let me tell you how that happened, and then I'll sit down and shut up. I had a very difficult time about women. Mike can tell you that. I mean, just a very difficult time about women. I was one of these kids who grew up, and I was short, and I always thought everybody was laughing at me, and I was very angry with women. And then all of a sudden, I'm sober and single and have a pretty decent job, and I was in Washington, D.C., where there are 12 women for every man, and I did a lot of things, and I'm not very proud of at all. And I sort of got sober to do that. And I always ended up in these relationships, and they were always selfish, and they were always self-centered. And I always ended up the same way, and that was everybody was hurt, and everybody blamed everybody. And I had to come up with a lot of good reasons for why I wasn't at fault. And one day, I knew that was over. And I was up all night praying. And my friend Dick Corcoran, who's since passed away, was up praying. And I told God, I said, "God," I said, "I know what I've been doing is wrong. And I promise you that I am going to live a celibate life. And I'm going to take every bit of energy I have, and I'm going to work with suffering alcoholics. And I'm going to begin to treat women with the kind of respect that I want to treat them with." And that day, the next day, I went to a meeting I hadn't planned to go to because our friend Bob, who's seriously ill now, was speaking. And that day I met a woman named Julia. And I was madly in love with her from the moment I met her. And I went to my sponsor and I said, "Tom, you're married well." I mean, he's like really married, you know. I mean, on weekends when he's away, I mean, he's really married. And I said, I want to be married like you. I don't want to be married if I can't be married like you. Will you help me do that? And Tom, and by this time I was sober 13 years, Tom began a process with me, which has allowed me to lay the foundation I need to have the relationship I have today. And I said to him, I said, very early on, I said, I think we'll have an exclusive relationship. He said, don't do that. You're not ready yet. And I said, but I really think it's time. He said, no, you're not ready yet. He said, you want to have an exclusive relationship because you're afraid somebody else will get her. And he said, and what you'll do is you'll resent her, and then you'll run around on her. And I said, we won't have an exclusive relationship yet. I said, you tell me when I'm ready for an exclusive relationship. He said, I will. One day he said to me, he said, I think you and that little gal are probably about ready for an exclusive relationship. I said, that's fantastic, you know. And I went to her and I said, I don't want to see anybody but you. And she said, I haven't seen anybody but you. And then I said to her, let's get married. So I went to Tom and I said, Julie and I have decided we're going to get married. He said, well, you can't get married. I said, why? He said, you're not engaged. I said, that's an old-fashioned idea. He said, well, I got to be that way for a reason, Keith. He said, I want you to buy her a diamond, and I want you to become engaged. So Christmas Eve, we were getting ready to go to midnight mass, and I was all dressed up and everything, and I had this diamond ring in my pocket, and it was a fire going in the fireplace, and I had this little house on a golf course. Heaven. And I was going to get down on one knee. I'd already talked to her parents and asked permission, and they gave it to me. And I was going to get down on one knee, and at the last minute she said, well, and I didn't know how to do it and what to say, and she said, well, I better fix my face. And she went in the bathroom. I chased her in the bathroom. I put the ring on her wrong finger, the wrong hand, and said, would you like to be engaged? And she fell into my arms in tears. And we went off to mass that night, and we just look at each other and start to cry. And until that moment, I never knew how badly I wanted to be engaged and how different it is being engaged than having an exclusive relationship. How much more spiritual it is. And then one day, I said to Tom, I said, we're going to get married. He said, yeah. He said, you've waited a couple years. You've done this properly. He said, I think it's ready. I said, you know, Julia has a chance to transfer her job now. And so we're going to live together. And then we're going to be getting married. He said, no. I said, everybody's doing it. He said, I don't sponsor everybody. I sponsor you. And he said, I know what's right for you, Keith. He said, you've come so far, don't blow it now. He said, people understand lovers wanting to sneak away or something. He said, but don't live together in the society and in the town, he said, that you live in. He said, do it properly. And you know, I waited, and we got married and did it properly. And my mom and dad were there, and her mom and dad was there. And you know, and I brought her home to our house, and I carried her across the threshold. And I never knew how special it was until that moment. And that's why I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I'm learning to do things the way I always wanted to do them. I'm doing things the spiritual way, and they pay off. And you know, I'm no longer jealous, and she's no longer jealous. Because we don't have to be. I used to think that I was jealous because of the way people were. And I know now that jealousy is my disease, and it's the way I am. I wasn't living the kind of life I needed to live. And the fruits of that were jealousy and distrust and everything that went with it. Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me to live the way I've always wanted to live. And then the real key to this thing is that we get to pass it on. And I sponsor a bunch of guys now who want to do exactly the same things I wanted to do. And I'm able to help them the way I've been helped. You know, being here with you in this beautiful town, in this beautiful hotel, with this wonderful committee, has really been a privilege. Being with my dear friend Mike, my best friend in the whole world, Mike. We're prayer partners. Mike came to my apartment 20 years ago and said, I'm going to talk to you about God. And I cursed him and called him all those names and everything. And he just smiled and said, I'm still going to talk to you about God. And then one day, he taught me to pray. And we pray together. We pray together a lot. We walk the beach and pray together. And we keep lists of people and things that we pray for and about. And we exchange lists. And every day I pray the fifth decade of my rosary for Michael, and he prays one for me. So I know every day I'm being prayed for. To be here with him and to be here with Michael and to meet Joe and to see my dear friend Peggy again, it's a miracle. And I just can't tell you, I can't tell you how grateful I am to be part of your life. I'd like to close by recalling a time that I was in this little treatment center, and I called this woman that I had tormented so. And I said to her, I said, "You know what?" She said, "What?" I said, "I'm an alcoholic." She said, "No shit." And I said, "Why me?" And she said, "Why not you? If anybody deserves it, you do." And she hung up the phone. You know, 7 years later, I moved from Washington, D.C. to North Carolina, and I'm sitting on a balcony of a little apartment I had then. And I was talking to God as I understand him, and I said, "Father, why me? Why have you picked me to give this life to give sobriety to give your son to? Why have you picked me?" You know what I heard him say? "Why not you, son? If anybody deserves it, you do." And that's the blessing of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm able to live the life that my father always wanted Prince Keith to live. Thank you very much.
I just want to thank Keith very much for coming all the way from North Carolina to share with us. I just want to say that when I first called him, both he and Mike lived at an address on a beach, and I had in my mind that they would be sitting out in a little beach chair with a little, you know, telephone beside them and a bowler hat and with a telephone waiting for it to ring for people to ask him to come and speak. And I've had that in my mind ever since last April, and I still do so. Now they can go back to their beach, and thanks so much for coming to share with us. Thank you, Keith. And for all those who wish, we would close with a serenity prayer. God,
grant me serenity.